Today's reading is 2 Samuel 23, 8 to 9. Someone's earring. All right, 2 Samuel 23, 8 to 9. These are the names of David's mighty warriors. Josheb, Besahath, Beth, and Taketh-Monite was the chief of the three. He raised his spear against 800 men, whom he killed in one encounter. Next to him was Elzar, son of Dodai, the Ahohite, as one of the three mighty warriors. He was with David when they taunted the Philistines, He was with David when they taunted the Philistines gathered at Pasadim for battle. Then the Israelites retreated, but Elzar stood his ground and struck down the Philistines till his hand grew tired and froze to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day. The troops returned to Elzar, but only to strip the deed. Next to him was Shammah, son of Agi the Harite. When the Philistines banded together at a place where there was a field full of lentils, Israel's troops fled from them. But Shammah took his stand in the middle of the field. He defended it and struck the Philistines down, and the Lord brought about a great victory. During the harvest time, three of the 30 chief warriors came down to David at the cave of Adullam, while a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. At that time, David was in the stronghold, and the Philistines' garrison was at Bethlehem. David longed for water and said, "Oh, that someone would get me a drink of water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem." So the three mighty warriors broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. But he refused to drink it. Instead, he poured it out before the Lord. "Far be it from me, Lord, to do this, he said. "Is it not the blood of men who went at the risk of their lives?" And David would not drink it. Such were the exploits of the three mighty warriors. Abishai, the brother of Joab, son of Zeruiah, was chief of the three. He raised his spear against the 300 men whom he killed, and so he became as famous as the three. Was he not held in greater honor than the three? He became the commander even though he was not included among them. Benai, son of Jehoiada, a valiant fighter from Kabzeel, performed great exploits. He struck down Moab's town's mightiest warriors. He also went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. And he struck down a huge Egyptian. Although the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, Benai went against him with his club. He snatched a spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. Such were the exploits of Benai, son of Jehoiada. He too was as famous as the three mighty warriors. He was held in great honor than any of the other 30, but he was not included among the three. And David put him in charge of his bodyguard. Among the 30 were Ashil, the brother of Job, Elhanan, son of Dodo, from Bethlehem, Shammah, the Harodite, Ilkah, the Harodite, Helez, the Palatite, Ira, son of Ikesh, from Tekoa, Abizar, from Anathototh, Sabeki, the Hushite, Zalmon, the Ahite, Mahariah the Nephthite, Heled, son of Bana the Nephthite, Ithai, son of Ribai from Gabeah in Benjamin, Benai, the Pirathonite, Hidai from the ravines of Gash, Abai, Albon the Arabite, Asmath, the Barumite, Ilhabar, the Shalhobanite, the sons of Jashin, Jothan, son of Shammah the Harite, Ahim, son of Shahar the Harite, Ilphelet, son of Ahashabi the Makahite, Elam, son of Ahithophel the Gilonite, Hezor the Carmelite, Parai the Arabite, Igal son of Nathan from Zabon, son of Hagri, Zelek the Ammonite, Nahari the Berothite, the armor bearer of Job, son of Zerai, Ira the Itharite, Gareb the Itharite, and Ura the Hittite. They were the 37 in all.
Dude. I gave him an out. I said, look, if you want to read the first part, that's fine. I'll do the second half. He said, no, I'll do the lot. So, well done, man. Yes, I thought for today, knowing that we sort of, knowing that we will have a lot of our females, our women at the real retreat, I might take the chance and sort of focus today's study or today's sermon on, towards men, I guess. But I want to just say that everything I'm going to say, I think is just really applicable to anybody, no matter your gender, age, or whatever. So while I'm going to sort of talk about men a lot today, please do hear everything that's said and know that it's for all of us, really. And I want to kick off by asking the question, what is it that you think makes for a mighty man? The passage that we read just then is a passage towards the end of the book of 2 Samuel, and it talks about the men, or a group of men, and I'm not going to unpack each of them and verse by verse this morning, but I want to use it as really a teaching springboard for the life of a man called David. And he was surrounded by these men all throughout his life, really. And right at the end of 2 Samuel, it just gives us this description, just this list, really, of who they were. And it just labels them, these are David's mighty men. You also read of them in Chronicles and other places. And so hence the term mighty man. Okay? What is it that makes for a mighty man? Now you might think at this point, look, given all that we read about the descriptions of what made some of these men mighty in this passage, you might say, well, this is all just a bit too Chris Hemsworth for me, or too Russell Crowe and Gladiator and blood and swords and gore. Pick a different term, if you will. What makes for a solid dude? What makes for a good guy? What makes a young man, if you're young, what is it that you think will make you the man that you one day hope you will be? A good dude. A solid guy. What makes for that? What are the sorts of things that would turn you, turn me, turn us, turn men into a mighty man? A good guy. Well, I want to suggest for us this morning, there's two things from the passage. The first one has a few sub-points, but really only 2 points. The first thing that I want to suggest we see from David's mighty men is that what makes a mighty man is, in fact, other mighty men. What makes for a mighty man is other mighty men. I heard a saying recently, and I tried to find it on the internet who said it, but I couldn't find it, and I asked a few people, and nobody can tell me, nobody that I thought might have said it to me could verify it, but it goes like this. It says, show me your five closest friends, and I will tell you your future. Show me your five closest friends in life, and I'll be able to tell you your future. Now, of course, it's an imperfect statement. But let's take it at face value. I think there's a bit of truth in there. You see, David, as a man of God, and David was held up by the Bible all throughout as a man after God's own heart. He was, other than Jesus, who we'll get to in many ways in human history and in Christian history, one of the greatest examples of men, right? And it struck me as I read through 1 and 2 Samuel, Dana and I did that earlier in the year, it struck me just how prominent these other men and their wives and families were in David's life all throughout his life. I always thought his mighty men were sort of people who came later on, who joined him. You know, after he became king, after he became successful, and they're essentially somewhere in this gray mix of cronies, military people who he made appointments for in his nation state, you know, and that's sort of the mixture of all that kind of political business and kingship business. But it's not the case. Because there's a place in Samuel where David, long before he is king, he's a nobody, really. He's on the run. In fact, Saul, the previous king, if you know the story, it's helpful. If you don't, he's a fugitive. He runs for his life. Another king wants to kill him. And then he lives in this place, in a place called Ziklag, where he strikes a bargain with the local chieftain. And he lives there for a year and a half, just about, with 600 other men and their families. This is 9 or 10 years before he's king. And so I'll suggest to you, if you know the story of David, I think everything we can say of David, we can say of the community that he was a part of. David, the man of God, was a mighty man because he was around other mighty men. He had this real interesting kind of deep set of relationship with others. In this passage we read this morning, those three guys in particular in the beginning, they were the tightest of the tightest in that mob, right? We can also think of David and Jonathan, his best mate who died. What makes for a mighty man is other mighty men. And so, men, I need to ask you, I need to ask myself, do you have other men in your life who brings the best out of you? Are you part of a set of the closest friend in another man's life out of whom you bring the best? What will make you into a mighty man is other mighty men. Other mighty men with whom you have relationships that are, first of all, lifelong and deep. Relationships, as I've already said, David had with some of these intimate inner circle men of his were lifelong. They were deep. They weren't superficial. They weren't shallow. They were deep. Long. Right? Second thing about the relationships that David had with his mighty men, they carried great loving loyalty. Love that story in the passage from verses 13 to 17 where David's hiding in this cave of Adullam and he reminisces to his people, oh, how what I would give for a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem. I don't think he asked them to go and get water because Bethlehem, where this was besieged at that stage. Any idea of going in there would have been like walking right into Ukraine at the moment to get something for someone. It was extremely dangerous. It was extremely threatening. He didn't command his men to do it. I think he just said, oh man, this sucks so much that we have to sit in this cave and that we're running for our lives. What I would give just for a good drink of water from the well of Bethlehem. And I think, again, out of that loving, loyal concern, his mates, good, godly mates, said, oh well, let's do it for him. Let's go and get it. And they do, at the risk of their own lives, right? And they bring it back. And then David does this bizarre thing. Did you catch that? David takes it. He goes, wow, this is great, but I'm not going to have it. And so the text sort of said he pours it out before the Lord. Now, we initially might want to read that and go, oh, gee, that stinks. These guys put their lives on the line for you and you just chuck the water out. It's not quite that. I think it's actually David returning that sense of deep, loving loyalty to say, how can I do this? But we're all here as hundreds and hundreds of men in the same position. And so what he does, and this is a bit of an Old Testament thing that might be weird for you if you're new to Christianity, was the phrase is important. He poured it out before the Lord. It's a sacrifice thing. He says, no, I'm going to honor God. I'm not going to put myself above my brothers and above the rest of us who are in this situation. And he essentially takes this precious water as an act of sacrifice, an offering to God, right? Which says something really interesting about this whole thing about loving loyalty among mighty men. Because you might ask, hang on a second, this loyalty thing about men to each other, that has a dark side too, doesn't it? Well, yes, it can. I've seen groups of men who are loyal to each other. Gangs, mafia. I've seen even in a religious setting, and this is could be a sensitive topic for us, we're a complementarian church, male elders who become religiously sanctioned boys' clubs. They're no good for anybody. They're fiercely loyal. Footy mates are loyal to their other footy mates. Bikies are loyal to their other bikie mates, often to the point of death, but they're no good. What is so good about this thing then about David's mighty men? I think it precisely comes in the fact that it is love for God. Love for God that comes first. It's love for God that makes David go, look, I'm not even going to do this. I'll pour out this water as an act of love and solidarity for God and for my brothers. And in that sense, can I suggest to you that this is where godly, mighty men who are loyal to each other are different from other groups of men who are loyal to each other. It's a love for God first. And then it's a love for others. My brothers, the other mighty men, other people, right? Loving God and then loving your mates. Loving God, then loving your mates. The mafia does not love God, it's just love for mates. It's love for self, really. Right? Bunch of cronies who just drink all the time together and just gets involved into all the sort of stuff that men do. There's no love for God in there. There's just love for self. Love for each other. Mighty men love God and then they love each other. Under God, through God. And that makes them different. Makes them different from any other grouping of men that you'll find on the face of the earth. Extremely different. And it comes out in really what comes next, in the next 2 points of what makes for a mighty man. We've had already loving loyalty. We've had lifelong deep relationships. But now comes the real point of distinction. I'm going with L words here. And it's lowliness. Lowliness. That might sound strange because we've just been through a passage that tells about how dudes with swords kill hundreds of people and lions in the snow and all that kind of stuff. And you might be wondering, oh, what's with all the violence? That's another topic for another day, perhaps. I just recognize that. So what does lowliness have to do with David? Or what made any of these men mighty men? Good dudes. Well, it's actually in a very, very obscure detail right at the end of that long list of names that Etienne read so well, and that's kind of why I wanted it read out. There's a little line in there, in fact, the very last one. Among all these mighty men of David was Uriah the Hittite. Uriah the Hittite. probably one of the most upstanding of all of them, until his death. And he was murdered by David after he slept with his wife and she fell pregnant in an effort to try and cover it up. You see, we need to acknowledge that us men are wretched things, Homer says. Not Homer Simpson, the Greek writer. Wretched things. Even this incredible, mighty man of God, David, at some point in his life, fails. All men fail. It's not when you fail, it's how you fail. Not if you fail, when you fail and how you fail. And so David does this, you know, the story, do I retell the story? I don't want to bother you with spending a lot of time if you knew the story. Do we kind of know, just general way, do we know what happened with David and Bathsheba? Anybody not know at all what happened there, that part of the Bible? I don't want to put you on the spot, but I also don't want to spend another 7.5 minutes retelling the whole story. Okay, yeah, so we kind of get the gist of what David did, but here's what I think we get from that. Firstly, as I've already said, mighty men fail. Now, that's not what makes them mighty, but what makes them mighty is what David did when he was found out. Right? Eventually, prophet Nathan comes to him in the book of Samuel and says, more or less, tells him a little parable, convicts him, says, this is what you've done. Now, you have a choice there. He had a choice there. I have a choice there. When God convicts us of our failures, often kings in the Old Testament in David's position, it's a simple answer. Just kill the prophet. Just don't listen to him. Just ignore it. But David does something remarkable. He writes in Psalm 51, eventually, after this whole episode, he says, for I know my transgressions. My sin is always before me. He says of God, against you and you only have I sinned and done what's evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. David spends, because part of the consequences of his actions were that the child that Uriah's wife would bear, he would not live. The child would die. Yet David goes in his room. He refuses to eat. He fasts. He prays in the hope that maybe the child may live. And beyond that, he accepts the full consequences of what he's done. There's no arguing. There's no trying to self-justify. I mean, he has up to a point, but not from that point on. From the point where God spoke to him and said, David, this isn't right. He changes. Completely humble, completely lowly. Can I suggest to you that this is what would make any of us a mighty man as well? A mighty person. You see, I'm not that different to David. I too, in many ways, don't always love my brothers as I should. It's not like I'm trying to hurt them. It's not like I sit down and decide, oh, gee, how can I act or behave or think in a way that will inflict maximum pain on someone who's really dear to me? I think it just, in my fallenness and vagueness of heart and mind as a sinful human being, I just either forget, or I just don't even know myself well enough, or I'm not aware enough of how my actions actually hurt my brothers. And I think that's what happened with David and Uriah, more or less. I don't think he sat down and calculated how he could stuff this guy over. I think he just He just got carried away. Carried away in the sort of sins that beset all men at all times. And before he knew it, you know, he just done some stuff. And the murder, too, was not a case of let me stab him at night personally. It was a case of bring him in and, you know, let him spend a few nights with his wife while the rest of the army's off to war. But then Uriah says, no, I'm not going to go to my wife if all the army's out. And he really puts David to shame because he's this upright guy, much like David was in the cave, you know, years before. And then he goes and David says to the commander of the army, put him in the front lines in all the fighting because it's likely someone's going to have to die there. May as well be Uriah. In that sense, I didn't really murder him, you know, this was going to happen anyway. You know, see what I mean? He's not trying to sit down there and work out this evil, malicious plan. I think he's just trying to, I don't know, make life work. But in the process, he forgets. He forgets. He takes his eye off his brother. He says, what is really good for my brother? How do I love my brother? How do I seek his well-being? You know, and we do that too. I do that. Take our eyes off our brother, and we get overwhelmed in our own sense of ignorance, forgetfulness of how to love each other well. And then the key, of course, for us is too the same as for David. When we're confronted, how will we respond? Will we too be open to say, I know my transgressions. I know where I've stuffed up. I know where I am stuffing up right now. I know how I'm not loving my wife, my children, my friends. And when God shows us that, dear brothers, may we be so willing to admit it. You know, what's amazing about David is after all of this happens, there's great consequences for his royal line. One of his sons rebels and wants to kill him. And again, he gets kicked out and he's on the run. He's marching out of Jerusalem in shame, really, because his whole household is in total chaos. His life's in danger. And he marches out of Jerusalem with all his mighty men. Even then, they don't ditch him. They still stick to him. And it always did me in. I go, what is it about them that would make them cling to him? Is it just blind loyalty? Typically like a mafia gang would? I don't think so. I think they genuinely saw how he responds to his own failures and they admired that and they said, yeah, brother, we are still going to love you. The brothers would do that for each other now in the life of the church. Say, yes, I have failed. Sorry. Sorry for what I've done. Can you help me? Help me. Help me with my struggle. Help me with my failures. Don't hide it. This is what we tend to do. Just completely isolate ourselves and never share any of that with each other. So we're not in community in the first place, let alone sometimes then if we are, we expect that, oh, no, he's a Christian. He's not going to fail. No, he is going to fail. He has failed. You are failing. And you need to seek the help of your brothers in lowliness to walk with you, right? David shows us that too. After he responds in such a fantastic way to all these grotesque failures of his brothers stay with him and he with them all the way through. Not blindly, but because they see his lowliness, his humility. And then one last thing before I wrap up. Last thing that makes for a mighty man. It's the second point of the sermon, but it's not as long as the first one. What makes for mighty men is the mighty man. You need, in your five closest friends, Jesus Christ. David himself says of him, and it's wonderful language in Psalm 110, speaks of Jesus, but cryptically, the Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. He talks about the figure, we talk about him a lot, the prophets, the Messiah, the one to come, who is going to come. And so David knew of the coming of one whom he needed, and every one of his mighty men needed. He talked about Jesus Christ. It is in the man, Jesus Christ, his death on the cross, that David's prayer for the forgiveness of his failures are answered. David prays, have mercy on me, O God, in Psalm 51. According to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. Jesus is the mighty man who comes to you and he says, give me your failures. Put your failures on me. And I say, no, it would crush you. And he says, yes, yes. Yes, it has on the cross, but give it to me. He's the mate. The mate who comes along and says, give it all to me. Give me your failures. They're mine. I did it. It's my failures. And when we do, we go to the gospel where we know that Jesus rose from the dead. He says, not only does he take you your failures, but he gives you his success. He says, now I'm going to help you because I'm the mate who's going to come and say, yeah, I'll take all your stuff, all your failures, and then I'm going to give to you my strength, my perfection, my help. And under me and my mateship and companionship as one of your closest friend, your future is going to be a bright one. One in which you will grow to be lowly, one in which I will surround you with other men in loving loyalty, loving to God, loving to others, in lifelong, deep, meaningful friendship and fellowship. That's what Jesus does. Create in me a pure heart, O God. Renew a steadfast spirit within me. Don't cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me, but restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. What makes for a mighty man? Other mighty men and the mighty man. Walk with him and walk with others who want to walk with him. You're going to turn out well. You can only turn out well as a man in this world. So men, can I encourage you this morning, if you need to work on some of these things, I don't know if your walk with Jesus is dry and Jesus is not talking to you. I love how Jeremiah said it explicitly, at times at least, time in his word, time in prayer, time in bringing yourself to him with your own stuff and issues to put it on him. Can you return to that, please? Can you make it urgent business? Pray. Get back to the word. If you have no other Christian men in your life at all who you walk with, speak to you, and you share with, can you make that a priority? If you need to work less, and you can, work less, yes, put a dollar figure to that. It's going to cost you a lot of money, but it's worth every cent. If you can dial into, whether it's small groups or internships or just informally, off the record, where nobody even knows, would you do so, please? If you need to listen to stuff, podcasts, redeem some time on the road, or work, whatever, that's another form of Christian community. You can grow incredibly close to someone in your five circles without ever actually meeting them, just by letting them shape you and influence you as you listen to their teaching of godly men. Please don't forsake being a good dude because you don't have other good dudes in your life. Don't forsake becoming a great guy because you're not hanging out with the great guy who will shape you and mold you. Please pray with me. Dear Jesus, we thank you that you've come. You've come to be the great mate, the one in each of our circle of closest five friends, based on whom our futures can be predicted. because what is true of your future is true of our future in every way. So I pray that you will be very close in among our closest five friends or three friends. Become such a close friend to each person here. Man, woman, doesn't matter. You seek to be that close to each of us. Help us, as Pete prayed, to go that much deeper with you. But Jesus, your great gift to us is also other people. And so I pray. Firstly, I say thank you. I say thank you for the wonderful possibility of friendship and community of godly men that you've provided here in Pathway. God, I also want to pray for your forgiveness to the extent at which we still can be and should be better brothers for each other. Go even deeper. Bring more of ourselves in our brokenness just as we are, not just to you privately in prayer, but also to each other. And God, that our love for each other in our failures will be such that we will together be there for each other, lovingly loyal through the lowest periods of our lives, knowing that we can give you our stuff. You want it, and we put it on the cross. And then will you help us and raise us up, make us more and more mighty in you, Lord Jesus. We ask, we pray, in that name alone. Amen. Thanks. Music team.